Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this talk and reading, poet Matthew Dickman speaks eloquently about the often taboo subject of suicide. He says he can't offer an answer to the question, why do people commit suicide? But what he does offer, what he knows from the suicides of his brother Darren and close friends, what he has learned from research, and what other poets have written, is deeply illuminating. In his poem, Trouble, Dickman wrote, "The only way I could really talk about his suicide was by including him in this poem that is basically a long list of famous people who killed themselves. Because Darren was such a famous person in my mind and my heart." Matthew Dickman spoke at the temporary location on First Hill next door to the Fry Art Museum of Seattle's Hugo House on June 29th. His reading was presented by Hugo House in partnership with the Bagley Wright Lecture Series in Poetry. Please note, this recording contains explicit language and details about suicide. Here, Hugo House's Christine Texera introduces Matthew Dickman.
Hugo House is always excited to partner with the Bagley Wright Lecture Series to present events like this. Charlie Wright, the publisher of Wave Books, established the lecture series in memory of his late father, Bagley Wright. The series is directed by Charlie and Wave Books editor Matthew Zapruder. The lecture series is a nonprofit that provides leading poets with the opportunity to explore in depth their own thinking on the subject of poetry and poetics. And through financial and logistical support to arrange for the delivery of several lectures that result from these investigations, like tonight. So we're pleased to welcome a lecture from Matthew Dickman, who's the author of All American Poem, 50 American Plays, co-written with Michael Dickman, Mayakovsky's Revolver, Wish You Were Here, 24 Hours, and Brother. He's the recipient of the May Sarton Award from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the Kate Tufts Award from Claremont College, and a 2015 Guggenheim. He lives in Portland, Oregon, and directly following the lecture, we'll have just a brief Q&A with Matthew up here. So, welcome, Matthew.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. It's great to be in this sort of alternative space for Hugo House. Reminds me a little bit of some of the churches I went to when I was younger. You go out that door, go immediately into another door, buy a 40 of malt liquor, and some JoJo's. Let's see here. Like this room itself, my talk is brief. My experience with suicide, my ideas around suicide, the self, learning about the self is always changing. So this little talk I've only given twice, and in between each time, including at a bar in my neighborhood in Portland last night, I've made slight changes. Which part? Oh, you'll know.
Which bar?
Oh, which bar? Ray's Lakeside. Do you know it? It's great. It's great. You go, let's all go there after the talk. Get some Hugo House vans. I think the only thing that would be great to clarify before I read this out loud to you is just one clarification of language. And that is, when I talk about survivors of suicide, I'm not talking about the person who's attempted suicide and who's lived. I'm talking about all of you in this room. I'm talking about family members, lovers, friends. I think that's the only distinction you'll need to know. So I'm going to read from these pages to you, and then I'm going to stop. And then if you have any questions, which by now you're probably thinking, I can't imagine I would. You know, we can chat for a little while. the subject of suicide, though our artistic communities are too often depleted by it, is still very much a taboo. In his book, Suicide, Earl A. Grolman writes, "Suicide is a whispered word inappropriate for polite company. Family and friends often pretend they do not hear the word's dread sound, even when it's uttered. For suicide is a taboo subject that stigmatizes not only the victim, but the survivors as well." I believe the taboo Grolman talks about can be redirected into something more like benevolence. In Les Miserables, Hugo writes, "Suicide, that mysterious route toward the unknown. The unknown and the mysterious are two of the most powerful tools of poetry. They are, more often than not, why we write poems." In Jill Bielowski's fiercely smart, articulate, and compassionate memoir, History of a Suicide, My Sister's Unfinished Life, she quotes Edwin Schneidman, the late suicidologist and thanatologist, when he says, "The greatest fallacy about suicide lies in the belief that there is a single immediate answer, or perhaps combined answers, as to why the deed was done. Though we will not get to an answer to why people commit suicide, this short talk will touch on the complicated subject of taking one's own life through my experiences and some poems I've turned to for understanding. Poems which explore the mystery and investigate the unknown of this often misunderstood act." Usually taking my shirt off is not part of this talk. It seems inappropriate right now. It is hot. It is hot. So weird. The last three places I've read poems has people taken their clothes off. And you can tell by looking at me, it's not my fault that they're doing that. Suicide is far from being that exotic plant that we are told kills, but thank God does not grow in our neighborhood. And the fact is that the plant pollinates, regenerates, is common, and in one form or another grows beneath our feet even as we live and breathe today. These are four things I know to be false ideas about suicide. That the suicidal person kills himself or herself only out of passion and or a reaction to a singular event. That suicide is produced by bad weather. November has the lowest suicide rate of all the months in the calendar. Those who threaten to commit suicide do not go through with it. Those who attempt and fail never try again. And here are some truths that I know about suicide. According to some agencies, a suicide in one's family history increases his or her chances of dying from suicide up to 30% more than someone without that family history. Suicide takes the lives of nearly 30,000 Americans every year. Many who attempt suicide never seek professional care. There are twice as many deaths due to suicide than HIV/AIDS. Between 1952 and 1995, suicide in young adults nearly tripled. It has quadrupled since then. Over half of all suicides occur in adult males aged 25 to 65. Suicide is a common form of death among the elderly. Suicide rates in the United States are highest in the spring. Over half of suicides are completed with a firearm. For young people, ages 15 to 24, years old, suicide is the third leading cause of death. In Washington State, it is the second. Or Washington. There are an estimated 8 to 25 attempted suicides to one completion. The highest suicide rate is in men over 85 years old, 65 per 100,000 persons. One in 6,500 children ages 10 years old to 14 commit suicide. Today, depression is the number one disability in the world. An average of one person dies by suicide every 16.2 minutes, which means that by the end of our talk here today, upwards of four people will have already have died of suicide. In my dream about suicide, I'm standing in the corner of a room in my pajamas. In the center of the room, there's an old chair. It's beaten up, some stuffing coming out of it, a spring or two poking up from the seat. Right next to the chair, there's a small table, the tabletop the size of, let's say, a large book. And on the table is an index card. I know I'm supposed to sit in the chair, but it is surrounded by millions of other index cards that have been ripped in half. This sea of torn paper fans out from the four legs of the chairs into the four corners of the room. I pick up one of the torn cards and take a closer look. On it, I can read half of a person's name. I know the other half must be nearby, half a name lying on the floor. I know I'm supposed to sit in the chair, but I'm afraid. The index card resting on the table is not torn. And what's worse, what's unimaginable to me, is that my first name is already written on it. Whenever readers take a break to take a sip of water or beer, it always reminds me of like a Gatorade commercial for really unhealthy people. It just does, you know. Thank you so much. It's just they turn, they get some of this going. On Monday, October 16th, 2006, around 7 in the evening, my older brother, Darren Hall, committed suicide. He had been staying at his parents' home while they were traveling in England. His mother had been using fentanyl, a narcotic pain reliever in the form of 100 milligram patches. One patch carries a 12-hour dose. Darren had been experimenting with wearing two patches. If a fairly healthy person placed three patches on their skin, they would pass out within a few minutes. Without immediate care and IV fluids, this person would run the danger of permanent organ damage and perhaps the loss of life. As far as I can retrace and reimagine the final hours of my brother's physical life, it might look like this. Around 3 in the afternoon, Darren, who was an alcoholic, began drinking bottles of beer from a case he had purchased that day. He had put in a load of laundry, white t-shirts, a pair of jeans, some khaki pants, socks, some boxer shorts. Once the wash was done, about 30 minutes, he put the damp clothes from the washer into the dryer. He then walked upstairs to his parents' bathroom, removed the box of his mother's fentanyl patches, and brought them back downstairs into the room he was staying in. From there, he could hear his clothes turning round and round in the dryer. A ceiling fan was moving round and round above the bed. He pulled out 13 patches. He unwrapped each of them, took the sticky backing off of them, then set them on the bed he was sitting on and placed them, one after the other, quickly onto his bare chest. He passed out within 3 minutes. As the final patch was placed, he stopped breathing. Within 2 hours, he was completely dead. The fan turned and turned. I know that the fan moved my brother's hair as if he were still alive. Upstairs, the empty bottles of beer were neatly ordered on the kitchen counter. The house had been picked up. The floors had been swept. One of the many things surrounding my brother's death that I kept thinking about was the organization of the bottles, the cleaning of the clothes, the floors being swept. I think one of the misunderstandings about suicide is that the suicide himself is out of control. And although much of my brother's life was out of control, I can tell you, his final moments on earth were absolutely not. He had dealt with depression his whole life, most likely from the age of 6 years old and on. Though it should also be pointed out that not everyone who suffers depression will kill himself or herself. My brother Darren's depression, as he once described it to me, was a kind of bright physical pain that existed inside him and outside him at the same time. It was like air. So not only was his body in psychic pain, he also walked through a kind of physical suffering in the world. But that world, in the end, was organized. It's true that a suicide can happen, quote, out of the blue. That is, an opportunity for death presents itself, and the suicidal person takes it. But for my brother, this final attempt was planned, focused, organized. A poem that has helped me think about this kind of macabre organization is the late Joe Bolton's poem, In the House of Death. It speculated Mr. Bolton, also a suicide, he died in March 1990, the age of 28, wrote The House of Death less than 10 days before he died. In the House of Death, I felt what I felt were parts of me starting to fall apart. Outside, the bare tree shivered and the black bird shivered in the bare tree. I was afraid to walk out and pick up the morning paper till well into the night. I counted the cigarette butts, and I counted the empty bottles, and I counted the spaces they left. Sometimes after rain, the sun flared briefly, and the black birds slicked their hair back in the bare tree. They knew, as I did, that it was just a matter of time. And I was afraid to open up the paper and read of a world that had stopped having anything at all to do with me, unless it be news of my own death. And I put the cigarette butts into the empty bottles. Now I put the empty bottles into the empty sacks. And I dreamt there wasn't space enough in the world to hold them. And I dreamt they'd outlived me. And I slept. And slept, and slept, and slept, and slept some more. Not afraid to waken, but to wake. What initially drew me to Bolton's work was his wild imagery, his use of simile and metaphor. His poems are awash in these ecstatic poetic tools. But this poem seems very different to me. Although the crows seem to be metaphors for his own knowledge of what's to come, the poem is without simile, and the images are stark and concrete. It's as if he has, days before he takes his own life, come to a place without grand metaphor. without wild celebration, without images, and certainly without simile. This place Bolton is reminds me of Neruda's line about violence in his great long poem, Spain in the Heart, where he writes, "The streets ran with the blood of children, like the blood of children." That is, there are certain experiences we have as human beings where metaphor fails and the thing examined, experienced, or seen is just itself. Bolton's poem is similar. Looking at the opening stanza, I felt what I felt were parts of me starting to fall apart. The parts of Bolton falling apart, the self cracking, are not falling apart like anything else. The parts are not starting to fall apart like a house of cards or an elaborate lie. Instead, the self is simply falling apart as the self. I think this is crucial to understanding suicide. The life of the body and the life of the mind have reached a point where there is no other. There is no like. There is no as. The self is alone suffering. Indeed, the self is suffering the self. There is something fascinating to me about organization without metaphor, about an emptiness that's being filled up as someone is beginning to leave the planet. I counted the cigarette butts, and I counted the empty bottles, and I counted the spaces they left. And then later, I put the cigarette butts into the bottles, I put the bottles into empty sacks, and I dreamt there wasn't space enough in the world to hold them, that there was no containment, that my pain and my suffering could no longer be contained by bone and organs and skin. It could not be contained by relationships. It could not be contained by the sky. It could not be contained by the ground. Well, I don't think the world can actually contain any of us. Not our empty bottles and empty sacks. Not my brother Darren. Perhaps one of the things that is so confusing for us, the survivors of suicide and yet to be survivors of suicide, is that there are two different worlds and yet the same. I see in his poem Joe Bolton's exhausted body, even at that age in his 20s, his exhausted psyche. When I remember years before he died telling my brother Darren that I was afraid of dying, he looked at me and he said, "Why?" And I said, "Because I think I'll be lonely." And he said, "When you're tired, do you like to sleep?" And I said, "I'm afraid it's going to be painful." And he said, "When you're tired, do you like to fall asleep?" I looked at him. I looked at the face I loved. And I said, "Yes." And I dreamt there wasn't space enough in the world to hold them. And I dreamt they'd outlive me. And I slept and slept and slept and slept and slept some more, not afraid to waken, but to wake. I met my friend Sam our freshman year of high school, September 1989. Among other things, he introduced me to the music of the Dead Milkmen, Sonic Youth, the skate park where I last stood on a skateboard beneath the Burnside Bridge. He always seemed to leap at things in life. He was fierce in his friendships, would protect you if you needed, would stay up all night while you howled over some lost love or was, like I often was in high school, lost on acid. He was also a young boy dealing with what turned out to be an almost crippling depression, but also a depression that went in waves. The waves, early on, being accompanied by a kind of experimentation, something close to attempts. There were whole months when Sam's shadow did not appear. But even during these clear days, Sam was always convinced that he would commit suicide. His ideas about his own mortality were not merely romantic high school blues. They seemed not only part of his DNA, but also an engagement with a kind of self-love. He seemed as committed to this as he did in any of his other friendships. He often talked about it in a tone that could have been used for reading a shopping list. It was that matter of fact. He had, as one of our favorite bands was called, a suicidal tendency. This tendency he lived with until 1999, 10 years after we had met. Soren drove his old car, a Datsun he had in high school, to a wooden area near the Willamette River in Oregon. There, he duct taped a hose to the exhaust pipe of his car, ran it along the ground, up through the passenger side window. He rolled the window up to catch the hose, then duct taped the open space between the hose and the window, blocking out the air. He turned on the car. He turned on the stereo. But to be sure, he sat back in the driver's seat, pulled a straight razor out of his pocket, removed the small piece of cardboard protecting the blade, and as the car began to fill with gas, Sam cut his wrists. The conversation with suicide he had been vocal about for so long was finally realized. I believe the river his car was facing continued to flow toward the Pacific Ocean, even though he had died. For me, no poem I've ever read talks as clearly of this kind of self-love or love affair, if you'd rather, as Anne Sexton's poem, Waiting to Die. Since you ask, most days I cannot remember. I walk in my clothing, unmarked by the voyage. Then the almost unnameable lust returns. Even then, I have nothing against life. I know well the grass blades you mention, the furniture you've placed under the sun. But suicides have a special language, like carpenters. They want to know which tools. They never ask, why build? Twice I have so simply declared myself, have possessed the enemy, eaten the enemy, have taken on his craft, his magic. In this way, heavy and thoughtful, warmer than oil or water, I've rested, drooling at the mouth hole. I did not think of my body as needlepoint. Even the cornea and the leftover urine were gone. Suicides have always betrayed the body. Stillborn, they don't always die, but dazzled, they can't forget a drug so sweet that even children would look on and smile. To thrust all that life under your tongue, that all by itself becomes a passion, death's a sad bone, bruised, you'd say. And yet she waits for me, year after year, to so delicately undo an old wound, to empty my breath from its bad prison. Balance there, suicide sometimes meet, raging at the fruit of a pumped up moon, leaving the bread they mistook for a kiss, leaving the page of the book carelessly open, something unsaid, the phone off the hook, and the love whatever it was, an infection. Right away, Sexton describes in clear, haunting terms for me her daily life with suicide, a life that was, in its way, non-responsive to the living world around her. Since you ask, most days I cannot remember. I walk in my clothing, unmarked by that voyage. Then the almost unnameable lust returns. Often, survivors of suicides will be baffled as to the how of the death, almost more than the why, and will sometimes use the how to triage and understand the death or to make a reason for it. Like, jumping equals flying. He jumped off the bridge. He always wanted to fly. But it's not the thrill to fly or drive fast that the suicide is committed to. It's the imagination of the act, the particulars. But suicides have a special language. Like carpenters, they want to know which tools. They never ask, why build? In looking at, or trying to understand, the repeat suicide attempts in Sam's life, Sexton's seventh devastating stanza, explaining the draw and psychology of her own attempts, describes the almost indescribable desire of and for suicide. Stillborn, they don't always die, but dazzled, they can't forget a drug so sweet that even children would look on and smile. Suicide, in its nature, is death. It is a stillborn, but it's also compelling as a drug. A drug, I would suggest, of healing. A healing drug for the suicidal. And I think Sexton suggests, also innocent. It is not an aggression against the world, but something even a child, and here is this child, innocent self of Sexton, would look at and be at ease with. I find the last three lines of wanting to die to be the most complicated lines in the poem. I wish they weren't. I wish they were as clear as the rest of the poem. But they read, leaving the page of the book carelessly open, something unsaid, the phone off the hook, and the love, whatever it was, an infection. Is the love she writes about suicide? Is it, at the end of this inevitable poem, a part of the poet calling for help, telling us she's sick? I don't think so. Sexton, like Sam, was not private about suicide. Instead, and this is the complicated part, one of many, love, whatever love she found in life, was the infection itself. Was part of the greater illness and suffering that she experienced. The night of our high school winter formal, Sam left early. He had been dancing with a girl he liked since sophomore year and suddenly was walking out of the gym. I was outside, sneaking a cigarette. "Where are you going?" I asked. "Home," he said. "Why?" I asked. "I don't feel good." When I was 15 years old, I was lucky enough to meet a girl named Bethany. Bethany and I had this great summer romance. We smoked pot in the park near my house. We made out all the time. I don't know if this is too intimate to share, but she was the first girl I ever went down on. It was fucking amazing, you know? We listened to The Cure. We smoked clove cigarettes. It was epic. 15-year-old epicness. And as many relationships, like summer romances, happen with like little kids, like 15-year-olds, you know, we ended up, because like grown-ups can't seem to handle this, but like we ended up remaining friends. Good friends. For another 10 years. And then on her 25th birthday, surrounded by other friends, she jumped out of her sixth-floor apartment window in the middle of the party. Bethany died on impact. She was, as one friend said, unrecognizable, but for the yellow summer dress she had on and her tennis shoes, both of which were soaked in blood. This public act, though immediately it may seem selfish to you, was, I believe, not as public as it seems. Bethany had been dealing with manic depression from childhood on. She was, even when manic, mostly alone, no matter how many people were standing near her, no matter how many clubs she went dancing in. In her manic hours, she would call me and want to drive to the beach and swim to the ocean. Even when it was 3 a.m, and even if it was December and the ocean was Pacific, she wanted to go there. When she was depressed, she would call and threaten to kill herself. I took her seriously, though, time after time. But then when she didn't, when the ambulance wasn't needed, I fell into this fallacy about suicide, this boy who cried wolf fallacy. I began to think that she only wanted attention. I was often frustrated, tired. Eventually, I didn't know what to say to her anymore. This complicated feeling, this exhaustion turned into mistrust, I think is eloquently written about in Jack Spicer's A Poem Without a Single Bird in It. What can I say to you, darling, when you ask me for help? I do not even know the future or even what poetry we are going to write. Commit suicide. Go mad. Better people than either of us have tried it. I loved you once, but I don't know the future. I only know that I love strength in my friends and greatness and hate the way their bodies crack when they die and are eaten up by images. The fun's over. The picnic's over. Go mad. Commit suicide. There will be nothing left after you die or go mad but the calmness of poetry. In this poem, I felt a brotherhood to my complicated feelings for and with Bethany. There's nothing more blunt than the opening two lines. What can I say to you, darling, when you ask me for help? I certainly have felt the line Spicer's written. It feels like a poem he wrote while sitting around in the basement of my heart. And I suppose I wanted to share this poem with you because it touches on and helps me to be okay with that basement and all the old fucked up furniture that's been covered with sheets and plastic and dust and confusion. And I like the call of the three lines at the end as well. The celebration of life through suicide and insanity sleeping beneath our beds. Go mad, commit suicide. There'll be nothing left after you die or go mad but the calmness of poetry. And what is left was there all along. A calmness, a living thing, art, human creation, love, and also this. For us to remain sane, we all pay money to this narrative we have that the sun comes up and then goes down. It's followed by the moon. That we have an arc. We have meaning in life. And we have love. In my dream about suicide, I'm standing in the corner of a room wearing the pajamas I used to wear in high school. In the middle of the room, there's an old chair. The seat of the chair has been slashed several times. Stuffing is coming out, a couple springs poking through. It looks as though someone has left it out in a backyard that rain and snow and sun has aged it. Next to the chair is a small wooden bedside table about the size of a book. And on the tabletop is an index card. Surrounding the chair and table is a sea of torn paper, fanning out from the four legs of the chair to the four corners of the room. I know I'm supposed to sit in that chair. I look down at my feet. I'm feeling a little cold right now. I'm shivering even. I'm worried I'm going to faint. I bend over and pick up one of the torn pieces of index card and can make out half a name. It's my older brother's name. I pick up another and read it, and it's Sam. Then I begin to walk slowly toward the chair. I can feel the cool pieces of paper around my ankles like a pond. I pick up another. It's Bethany. Another, another, another. Now I'm standing in front of the chair. The only sound I hear is the sound of my very own blood vessels. I turn around and I sit. I'm not supposed to be here, I think. I look around the room. I look toward the corner of the room where I'd been standing for what felt like hours. I pick up the index card from the table. On it, I can see that my first name has been written, but that my last name is missing. Then I see what I couldn't when I was standing in the corner, a black pen. I know what this is. I've felt it walking over bridges. I've felt it working at Whole Foods, cutting up cheese with a sharp knife. I've felt it staring in my closet for 20 minutes, looking at the bar and the shirts hanging. I know what this is. This is a choice. I can, if I want, pick up the pen and finish writing my name. It would be so easy. 7 letters. D. I. C, K, M, A, N, but I don't. I just stare at the card. I say my first name out loud, and then, as if I know each one, I look out at the ocean of torn cards and begin to say their names too. This, I tell myself, is called witnessing. This, I tell myself, is an artist engaging in the dark. And with each name, the papers swirl and the chair begins to mend itself. The papers come together. I stand up straighter. Things are going to be okay. We're all going to mend. I see I've written D. Even then, and even now, I wish for all our mending. I wish for the mending of our friends, for the mending of our mothers and fathers, for the mending of our children, for the mending of our lovers, for the mending of people we'll never meet. I thank you for your time. which I think is wildly precious. Thank you. It is super fucking hot in here, right? Yeah. Maybe instead of a Q&A in here, oh, we can just like get a drink and maybe we can like stand outside. I'm saying things that may not be what you, is that okay?
Yes.
Is that cool?
Yes.
We can go back in the courtyard. Yeah, let's go back. Oh, great. Let's go back in the courtyard and hang out for a little while. Mend each other and then go on with our nights, okay? Thank you so much for sitting here and listening to me. Thank you.
That's it for this podcast extra from Speakers Forum. Hugo House and the Bagley Wright Lecture Series presented this talk and reading by poet Matthew Dickman on June 29th. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum.